All right. Okay, so I'd like to thank Heidi for organizing a really great conference, and Joe and the others. It's been a real pleasure to be here. I am a little trepidatious here because I'm, first, this is a really combative audience. And I tend to do this. I sort of tell myself I'm going to get a lot of work done before a conference, and so I just, you know, give a topic, and then I find that I'm like down to the wire getting results. So some of this is fairly new, but I think it's interesting, and so I'm just going to quickly tell you a little bit about some efforts some things we've been working on, trying to see whether there's this a way to measure, you know, if the halos rotate, as Ray, you know, talked about, do they rotate steadily or do they vibrate, and can we measure this? So my, you know, two of the collaborators I really want to highlight are Sarah Snyder and Joe Hoffer, who are undergrads at U of M, who do really amazing work. They just, you know, I wouldn't be able to survive without my undergrads. Adrian wrote this really cool piece of code called Gala, which you'll see I've used a lot, and my other collaborators, Jeremy Balin, Eric Bell, and Richard D'Souza, have helped a lot. Okay, so we know from a long time, so like Ray, I'm trying to understand if there are ways to sort of distinguish between dark matter and, you know, I don't know, other theories or different types of dark matter. And so we know from cosmological simulations dating back several decades that halos are triaxial. They have typical axis ratios of, you know, at least in dark matter only simulations, fairly prolate triaxial. They have, you know, supposedly universal density profiles, and hundreds of dark matter subhalos. So these are predictions that have been around for, you know, nearly two decades. But one of the and one thing that we don't know even now is whether our disk is oriented perpendicular to the long axis. If the halo is triaxial, is it oriented perpendicular to the long axis? Is it oriented perpendicular to the short axis, or does it not matter? One of the earliest predictions, you know, which actually dates back before the discovery of subhalos, was Dubinsky in 92. It was already, of course, Dubinsky and Kalbaugh, Ray discovered that, you know, halos are triaxial, and then Dubinsky looked at the rotation of halos, and this was followed up by Balin and Steinmetz and Brian and Chris, but, you know, that is over a decade ago, and I think, except for Ray's work, I don't think there's been really much to look at whether or not halos rotate. But in this work, where they looked at halos from, you know, a set of cosmological simulations, I think they Balin's work looked at some 300 or so cosmological halos. They found that 90% of them did have figure rotation when you looked at the figure rotation within beyond about you know, about a tenth of a virial radius, going out to something like not quite a virial radius, but maybe half the virial radius, and they found that this figure rotation. So this is the this is a, you know, image from Jeremy's paper showing this. The figure rotation. The pattern speed is correlated with the halo spin parameter, but those two things are completely independent. The halo, you know, something that's not rotating could still have spin just because the particles are moving around in this triaxial figure. So those two things are independent, but he found that, in principle independent, but he found that they were correlated. And he also found that the rotation axis of the figure was aligned with the minor axis of the halo in about 50% of the cases, and that steady rotation can occur over periods of 1 to 4 gigayears. And so this is a plot of the phase angle, and it bounces around, but it's, you know, there is some steady rotation. He found, so Jeremy, both Joe, both Balin and Steinmetz, and then subsequently Byron and Kress, found that the pattern speed, or the the tumbling rate of these halos, is really tiny in these units that James dislikes, which actually turn out to be, as he said, not that different. So 0.1 kilometers a second per kiloparsec is 0.1 radians per gigayear, or 6 degrees per gigayear. So that's a, that's not a lot, right? But it's really tiny, and you should compare that with the pattern speeds of bars that we're familiar with, which are, at least close to an order of magnitude larger, more than an order of magnitude larger. So, and they're distributed in this log normal distribution with a certain width, and they found that there's fairly steady rotation outside one point, some video radius. So initially there were attempts to try and look for this, and it was proposed that you might find evidence for this in the very extended spiral features that you see in galaxies like this one. So this is the optical disk, and this is the H1 disk, and I don't know if you can see it, but there's an extended spiral arm going out to 22 optical scale lengths, and there's a bit of a bar. And so Becky and Friedman did some modeling and argued that if you had a halo, a triaxial halo inclined to the disk, and it was rotating at this pattern speed, then it could produce this extended spiral feature. The system doesn't have any companions. But these, and then this was followed up by other Messet and Bureau, who found that they needed a pattern speed of 6 or something kilometers per second per kiloparsec. So all of these numbers that they needed to explain this were, 40 times larger than was predicted from these cosmological simulations. So as far as I'm aware, this was the last effort that people have made to try and measure this pattern speed if it exists. So why is this interesting? The reason it's interesting is that if halos rotate, then it does require dark matter to be dynamic. You can't produce this on large scales. You can't produce this by rotation, rotation of baryons, because, the only thing we could be the bar, but the bar is so centrally concentrated, this is not going to produce rotation of things at, 50 kiloparsec. So we are looking for figure rotation on large scales, and the effects of that are likely to be, less affected by baryonic feedback. And so this makes it somewhat different from the other small-scale predictions of lambda CDM. So, the cusp core problem and the missing satellites problem, and all of those problems are extremely intertwined with our understanding of baryonic feedback. Whereas, because you're looking at something at much larger radii, we might hope that maybe it's less affected by this. Okay. So the goal of this talk, the outline of my talk, is to try and look into whether or not you can use observations of tidal streams, and in particular Sagittarius, to try and measure whether the halo might be rotating or tumbling or in some other some kind of mode of maybe vibration. I'm going to give you some, since the last work that I'm aware of where this was where people tried to look at this rotation was in a set of some of cosmological halos was back in 2008, and those were for dark matter only simulations. And since we know that the baryons change the shape of the dark matter, especially in the inner radius, making it much more oblate, making it harder to sort of identify, as was discussed in Ray's talk, what is the major axis, what's the intermediate axis. I mean, the axes are fairly close to each other, and so there's a little bit of this, what do you call a long axis? So I'm going to give you some very preliminary results on our effort to look at this in some illustrious halos, which have baryonic disks. And then I'll tell you a little bit about orbits and triaxial potentials, and then also then give you some back of the envelope calculations to motivate the idea that these very tiny pattern speeds actually can have a significant effect on tidal streams. And then use, I'll show you some simulations from the off the Sagittarius stream using Galla to give you some sense of what might be the primary signatures of figure rotations on streams. Okay, so the shapes of dark matters in dark matter halos and cosmological simulations are, you know, robustly triaxial. So this was known for a very long time. But when you put in the baryons, these halos get rounded, especially in the inner regions. And you know, but they do stay triaxial at large radii. So this is a plot from Marcel Zemp's paper I forget what the name of the collaboration is, but you know, Andrei Kravtsov, Oleg Nadin, and so forth. They found that that in the dark matter only simulations, of course, the axis ratios are you know, B over A, which is the intermediate to long axis is about 0.6, short to long axis is 0.4, but when you have the baryons, these are these red curves, you get much more close to oblate. And so if you plot this quantity called the triaxiality parameter as a function of radius, you have oblate halos within a tenth of the virial radius, triaxial between a tenth and, you know, sort of one virial radius, and then sort of a prolate beyond that. So the halo shape, in addition to being more oblate in the center, becoming more oblate at all radii, actually changes with shape. And so that is another complication. But we decided that we'll look at some illustrious halos just to, you know, to figure out, is this even a worthwhile question? Because if the halos are so round that they don't, you know, that it's impossible to identify any kind of rotation, then maybe it's a, you know, it's moot whether or not we should look at this. So we do the standard thing of trying to compute the moment of inertia tensor of the dark matter particles. So we picked 12 disks, Milky Way-like disk galaxies, mass disks from the illustrious simulations. We computed the inertia, moment of inertia tensors within 50, sorry? 1 minute?
No.
You are fine. Okay, sorry. Yes. within 50 kiloparsec and 100 kiloparsec, we diagonalize the moment of inertia tensor, compute these eigenvectors and eigenvalues, and then compute the axis ratios. But we only look at the halos if their axis ratios are you know, different from each other at redshift zero. They sort of remain different from each other. So this is something of a selection. But anyway, we haven't yet done a full analysis, but we'll come back to that. And then we look back at, you know, we take 16 snapshots back to 11.3 gigayears. The reason we don't go further than that is that the disks are not robustly clear in all these systems before that. I mean, the disks are still sort of flopping around, and we just wanted to be sure that there was actually a disk. And so that's not a lot of time. That's, you know, a few, three gigayears or so from here to redshift zero. Then we identify in each of these halos the you know, whether there is a stable axis of rotation. And in most cases, we find that at least if you look at the matter within 100 kiloparsec, there is a stable axis of rotation, sort of on average. So if you look within 50 kiloparsec, we find there's more flopping around, which you might expect because the halo is somewhat rounder. So then what we do is we look at that first snapshot and we align the coordinate system so that the x-axis is along the major axis and the minor axis is along z. And then we rotate all the other snapshots such that they're there. So we're sort of looking in the same place. So we're basically looking at the motion of the long axis. That we expect that the long axis is perpendicular to the z-axis initially, and then we'll look at, you know, how it changes, And then we look at how that long axis, projection of the long axis on the xy plane moves relative to, so the standard theta and phi coordinates. So this is just to make, I mean, there are different ways to do this, but this seemed like a simple way for my undergrad to do this, which was, because there are other, you know, much more complicated ways mathematically, but this was a simpler way to do this. And so when I plot, so these are just some sample halos. This is, we also look at the angle between the major axis of the halo and the rotation axis of the disk. Okay, so in this case, in this particular example, the disk is at 90 degrees. The disk is perpendicular to the minor axis of the halo, or the disk axis is parallel to the minor axis of the halo, and this is the angle through which the major axis rotates, and it's, you know, it's kind of there's no line to show fit, but it's about, it's rotating at about 9 degrees per gigayear, and this is rotating at about, I don't know, a little faster. It goes from 0 to I don't know, almost 100. It's about 35 degrees per gigayear, and in this case, you see that the disk is tilting slowly. It's going, you know, it's wobbling a little bit relative to the minor axis of the halo, and this has been studied fairly extensively by Sam Earp, Dave, and Victor De Battista and others. So I'm not going to go into that very much. But we found that about half of our halos that we looked at show the steady rotation over a period of three gigayears, with a pattern frequency between, you know, 0.15 and 0.6 kilometers a second for kiloparsec. So pretty close to, this is for the matter within 100 kiloparsec. This is pretty close to what was found in the cosmological dark matter only simulations. And then of course there are, you know, the other 50%, so this one shows a rapid rotation here and then nothing, and then some wobbling of the disk. This shows a very rapid rotation. This shows more like the, what I, you know, flip-flopping or vibrating that Ray was talking about. And so there's a great, you know, there's a great variety. And so I don't want to pretend that all of these halos show steady rotation or that it's occurring over a, you know, or a steady time period. But one of the things we do notice is the ones that, you know, that do have steady rotation don't typically have a lot of companions. They have maybe one companion coming by and causing some rotation slowly. And we felt that that may be something that's, you know, fairly relevant to, you know, to the something like the Milky Way. Okay, so I'm going to move on now to looking at orbits of streams, streams in these, in a triaxial halo. And so to just remind you of the orbit families in triaxial potentials, we know that there are these four major orbit families. The one that I'm going to focus on for the purposes of this talk are these outer long axis tubes. And we've known for a while that all these orbits are affected by figure rotation. So I'm going to write down here for you, just to remind you that what the rotation, you know, if you're in a rotating frame, then you have, of course, these equations of motion. This is just the acceleration. This is the, these are the terms which come from the centrifugal acceleration. These are the terms which come about from Coriolis force. So I don't know, that didn't work. So just to remind you about that Coriolis force, if you're in a rotating frame, then, you know, something which is, looks like it's moving in a straight line from an inertial frame appears to curve around in the rotating frame. And so the question is, at our location at 8 kiloparsec in the Milky Way, should we be assuming that we're in a rotating frame? Maybe not, but because we normally translate all our measurements to this inertial galactocentric frame. But given that at 8 kiloparsec, if you have a rotation frequency of 0.1 kilometers a second, the difference in velocity is about one of, you know, like really small, smaller than I think is really measurable. So I'm going to just assume that we are okay working in this rotating frame. Okay, so if you have these long axis tubes, they are tipped about the intermediate axis by a Coriolis force. If you have rotation about the short axis, they're tipped about the intermediate axis, and the direction in which they're tipped depends on their angular momentum about this about the long axis. So if the long axis is x, then if the rotation is positive, then they get tipped in one sense, and if the rotation about that axis is negative, they get tipped in the other sense. Okay, so this was initially, just realizing this was my motivation for sort of looking at this, because I thought, well, maybe it's interesting. To give you a sense of, you know, let's do some quick back of the envelope calculations. If you have an isothermal sphere with some, you know, rotation velocity of 200 kilometers a second, imagine you're looking at a stream at 50 kiloparsec with a stream velocity of 150 kilometers a second, then this gravitational acceleration term, so if you go back to those equations of motion, the gravitational acceleration, in again, in some weird, ugly units, kilometers a kilometers squared per second squared per kiloparsec. Okay, so I'm making matters much worse, but anyway, it is nice small numbers. So this is about 800. And then if you look at the centrifugal acceleration term, you get something like this. The Coriolis acceleration terms are like this. So these are the pattern speeds that we're talking about. And just comparing what that those terms are relative to gravitational, you see that the Coriolis acceleration is actually quite a significant percent of, you know, fraction at 50 kiloparsec. It's not small. And you can also see that if you had a pattern speed of 5 kilometers a second per kiloparsec, it would significantly exceed the gravitational acceleration at that radius. So you know, I mean, things would be just flying away. Basically, they'd be pushed apart by that, which may be why we don't see those kinds of rotations. So this is the regime you're working in, and this seems to me significant. So the long, you know, I was thinking about long axis tubes, and this model for the Sagittarius stream assumes that the long axis is perpendicular to the plane of the stream. Right? So it's a weird model. The short axis is in the plane of the disk, and the intermediate axis is perpendicular. But nonetheless, this assumes that this is a polar stream, and so let's assume that it's, you know, on a long axis tube kind of thing. So I just took, you know, Gala, I don't know how Adrian pronounces it, and we put in some, you know, something like 50 different initial orbits very close to produce this kind of, you know, very thin stream, thin polar stream with slight thicknesses. I'm just showing you two here. And this is what it looks like in a static triaxial halo. This is the orbit, this is the stream, and this, you know, once you have, as I said, these orbits get tipped over if you have rotation, and you see this. But it turns out that if you look at this, if you look at sort of just a sample of these orbits, about 10% of planar streams in this stationary kind of halo will also show tilt, compared to like 78% of streams in a rotating halo. Okay, so yeah, so this was my initial sort of thinking of, you know, the plane of Sagittarius is tilted, so maybe it, you know, it could tell us something about, you know, the tilt might be telling us something about this motion. So we, you know, we've done a bunch of simulations. Well, they're test particle, you know, sort of these spray model simulations, particle spray simulations. I haven't been trying to model the Sagittarius, but it turned out that just looking at these sort of trial streams was not particularly helpful in guiding my intuition. And so I sort of set up a system which has a triaxial NFW halo, bulge, Miyamoto Nagai disk. And then I just chose, you know, just four different shapes of the halo and oblate, something which is actually fairly almost spherical, an oblate, something which is, the, you know, has the shape of the law model, a model which is prolate and, you know, was described by Fardal as being the best model to fit some certain properties of Sagittarius. And this halo, which comes from observations of the globular cluster distribution, which I think is not correct because it uses a gamma in an incorrect way or something. Maybe it's correct, I don't know. But anyway, it's just a model which is fairly prolate. So I just use these, there is no dynamical friction. The satellite doesn't have, doesn't exert gravitational force on the particles. And so there's lots of simple approximations here. Okay, so to sort of look at the kinds of data, I put in the initial coordinates of the current coordinates of the Sagittarius dwarf as from the Gaia collaboration, and used a few different progenitor masses, but because it's a test particle simulation and there is no gravity, just increasing the mass means that you just end up with, just large volumes of particles. And so I'm just going to show you things with small numbers of particles, but because it's, that's fairly standard for these spray simulations. And then I compare with these sets of data. So these are not interesting. You don't see, the main thing is that I just want to show you is that you can, so the red is the trailing, blue is the leading. You can produce, these simulations. This is an oblate halo. They don't match this, but this is well known. I don't have dynamical friction. The rotation curve is not flat enough. The leading apocenter is too far out. You sort of produce the angle between the leading and trailing tail in the static halo. The static oblate triaxial halo doesn't give me the velocities, but then that's known too. It's been a well-known problem. So the thing that I want to show you is that the rotation does do is it causes precession in the plane. So here is the static halo. This is the oblate halo, and it's static. So it produces, leading, trailing, etc. And if you look in this plane, this is, that's the plane of the stream. This is what it looks like if the halo is rotating counterclock, with negative rotation, positive. I said the Coriolis force is the rotation cross with the velocity. So you expect it to be the largest when these two things are perpendicular to each other. So the rotation is about this axis, and so the velocity here is sort of tangential somewhat. So I would expect the effect to be strong here, and with the trailing arm, I expect it to be to be strong there and there, because that's where the velocities are perpendicular to the rotation axis. And because this is, here the stream is going in one direction and in here it's going in the other direction, the velocity vector has changed, so I expect the effect to be to be the opposite. And you do see this to a certain extent. So here is, you see that this, this end is tipped in this direction, whereas this is tipped in this direction, and this is tipped in the opposite direction of that, and this is tipped in the opposite direction of that. So physics is working, it's doing what we expect, and so this basically is telling you that the planes are going to precess, but you don't see very strong effects. As I said, you don't see effects in anything. The only thing you see is if you transform this to the, am I completely out of time? 2 minutes, okay. To the Sagittarius coordinates, this is the standard Majewski Sagittarius coordinates, lambda and lambda naught and b naught, you see that this precession causes the so this is distance, the color is heliocentric distance, this is the trailing and the leading, and you see that these things move relative to that plane, which was what I said. There's that precession, they get tilted in different ways depending on where they are, and so you see this this is this offset. This is along that stream, this is below, and they move sort of in opposite directions. If you look at the proper motions, these points here are from the HST proper motions. I have not got around to putting in Gaia proper motions, but this is in the static halo, and you see that again, the behavior of the proper motion, so this is proper motion, in T, and this is the, sorry, this is in lambda along the stream, and this is perpendicular to the stream. They're not that different. What is different between these two plots is again, as I said, the color. And the color tells you what that, how, you know, how it deviates from the Sagittarius plane. So that's again the precession. So it's some parts are moving in one direction and some are moving in the other direction. And so this is quite substantial. These are, you know, quite substantial differences. And so they could be, you know, if we were able to sort of model the whole halo correctly, we might be able to do this. There's also then this other interesting observation, which is the bifurcation. And I'm not going to claim to explain this, but I want to just show you, no time left, okay. I'm just going to quickly go through this. If you have rotation, it actually changes the, again, this is because of the fact that you have a leading and a trailing stream. And so you end up sort of splitting this up. And so if you have something like the law model, you find that if there is any rotation, the stream just gets completely messed up. So these are, you know, these are really small amounts of rotation. So this is the law halo. And I find that at least with this, and of course, this is not a great fit either, but that's, and I think I'm going to stop here. So I do have a few more slides telling you about what happens if you rotate about the x-axis and the y-axis, but that basically, I think the main effect is this effect on precession, and so we can we'll see these effects on the precession of the different arms relative to the b equal to zero plane, and that will show up in this. So I'm going to just stop here, and yeah, just take questions.
So I think it's on one of the things that you were skipping at the end. How is there a degeneracy between figure rotation and something like the LMC?
I think I didn't put in the LMC, but what I'm trying to motivate is that something like the LMC, if it's coming from, you know, depending on, this is depending on the mass of the Milky Way. If the LMC is in these cosmological simulations where you have something coming by, the halo does sort of begin to rotate in response, right? The motion of the LMC would cause, if the halo is triaxial enough, could cause a rotation about the y-axis or about the x-axis. I think it probably most around the y-axis, and so we can. No, around the x-axis. So this is the xy plane. So I think the rotation will be most about, you know, in sort of in response. So the LMC is going like this. So I think that, you know, the Milky Way will respond in the opposite direction. So this is like the, you know, the motion of the barycenter, but right. So my thought is that. One way to think about it is that you can think of in the simulations, the figure rotation is produced by torques from companions, and the LMC might induce torques both in X and Y. And so one could, of course, think of this as just in this framework instead of putting in the orbit of the LMC necessarily. And that might help to take into consideration other satellites as well.
Yeah, so as a follow-on from Larry's question, I saw a report about 5 years ago from the large Gaia team that work on the Universal Reference Frame. One of them specifically looked at the issue of tumble. I think it was Klionis, K-L-I-O-N-I-S. He wrote some papers in ANA, and which I think concluded that you had to get to the end of the Gaia survey.
Right,
and
okay.
Even then, you had to have like microsecond level systematics across the sky, and they reckon that the tumble would be observable, and it was very iffy, like at three.
Were they
three
looking
or four
at the disk?
Yeah.
Right. So I think and there was also a paper.
That's
by
the figure rotation, the figure rotation of the halo.
But so what were they using as a tracer?
The issue of the LMC was in there.
Okay.
And they were using different populations. I can't quite remember the overall analysis, but I just remember the result, which was
right.
This would be possible when the Gaia survey was finished.
I think that the work also from Sam Earp, Victor De Battista and company also says that it should be detectable, but they were looking at effects on the warp, on the
that's
disk.
Right. The contributions from all the other sources were looked
right.
at the warp and
right.
the LMC.
So I think that is smaller than the effect on the Sagittarius stream, simply because it goes out much further. It's actually moving quite fast. So, you know, even at APO, the tangential velocity is quite large. And so you're helped by the fact that the Coriolis force depends on the velocity and I think that there are going to be centrifugal effects at the APO of the trailing arm, which might contribute to things like this fluff and so forth, because you see that. But I'm not entirely sure about, you know, I haven't looked at it in great detail. Yeah.
So going back to the initial part of your talk on the investigation of the illustrious halos.
Yeah.
Because the material in these hierarchical universes accretes more or less radially, it's not accreting that much angular momentum in average, except maybe when you have somewhat larger subhalos accreted.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering whether you'd looked at the effect of the accretion history on the numbers you got. Because we would probably have some information on the accretion history of the Milky Way as well. Than
right. Whether you mean look into whether there's a you can measure the angular momentum of the accretion history from the residual rotation.
Whether there's a relation between the figure rotation you measure and the accretion of somewhat larger subhalos.
Right. At some time in the past. Yeah. So we are looking at halos which, you know, as I said, we're only looking at them from 11.5 gigayears onwards, and we've specifically only looked at disks which look like they're fairly stable through that time. They're not, you know, if you accrete something quite massive, then the disk might get quite perturbed. And so we're looking at things without very massive accretions, but that might be something that we should look at as well. But.
So I wanted to pick up on Lara's point, and it's related back to the last talk as well, because
mm-hmm.
I think this is really fun, measuring things with the tidal streams, right? But what is it we're measuring? So just to repeat the question, I think I'm repeating again, but I really want to know the answer. If you have a slightly triaxial halo that's squashed, what's the quadrupole of that versus the quadrupole of 10% of the halos in lumps? So what's
mm-hmm.
the quadrupole of the LMC?
Yeah.
And what's the size of the two? Because then we know what we're going to be sensitive to. So if only 10% of the halos in lumps, you might think it's the dominant thing, but I don't have a good sense for that.
No, I'm not sure you can separate the two cleanly. I think they're intertwined. I mean, I prefer to think of it as, maybe you can think of the LMC as inducing a torque in the dark matter halo, and that is what, you know, that you could think of that as being responsible for. So I think the kinds of calculations that have been done with the LMC is to look at whether or not the LMC gets close enough to, you know, the pericenters of various streams, and what is their velocities relative to their, you know, to their orbit with the LMC. But if you think of this in terms of, well, maybe the entire halo is responding, and so you don't actually need to have passed that close to the LMC. You could be somewhere else, but if, you know, the whole halo has responded to it, then you will see these effects elsewhere as well. And the direction of those proper motions may not be necessarily pointed at the LMC, because it could be somewhere else. That's the way I'm trying to think about this.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to follow up still, because I guess I completely agree that they're intertwined, but I would have thought we could, couldn't we do a simple calculation of size of the effect, one, of just the size of the quadrupole of the LMC versus the size of the quadrupole of a triaxial halo. And secondly, time scale. The time scale for the LMC is Nobel time, right? So that's the time scale for the torque, whereas the time scale for the tunneling halo is much, much longer. So I'm just thinking.
Is it Hubble time? What do you mean?
Orbital time.
So the orbital time, yeah.
Whereas the time scale for the tunneling you told us was much, much longer. So I agree that they're going to combine, but I would have thought they have different scales and time scales.
So, no, you're right. I need to calculate how the quadrupole from the LMC, you know, or at least what the rate of tumbling of that is, and compare it with this. Yes.
Thanks. So I think maybe this is a follow-on to Catherine's question. What is the time scale for the change in the precession of the stream when you have these small pattern speeds at this? And I have a second question after this.
You mean how quickly are these things changing?
Yeah.
I don't know. Are the orbits that I'm evolving the orbits for, off Sagittarius for six giga years, which is, I don't know, similar to what other people use, maybe. So I didn't, and then I just look at the final position. I haven't looked at how the velocities change
over time. How it deviates over time.
Yeah,
right.
Because, I mean, they do, the streams move, right? So I guess one could look at that, see how their velocity perpendicular to the plane of the stream changes.
And presumably it's over, time scales longer than, a few hundred million years, right?
Yeah.
So my other question was, I'd looked at some of Victor De Batista's simulations that had the triaxial halos, and they were fairly triaxial. And what I found was that the I hadn't looked at, obviously in so much detail as you have here, but what I found is that the effect that they had on the warp, this is in the absence of any perturber, the effect that they had on the vertical structure was more significant than on the planar structure. And I'm wondering if you...
And was that in the case where it was rotating sort of perpendicular to the, about an axis in the plane of the disk?
Yes. Yes, I think so.
So causing more warping.
Yes.
Yeah.
Rather than, the changes from sort of equilibrium structure in the plane were quite small, but the triaxial halo itself, in the absence of any perturbers, did still produce a warp and.
Produced a warp. Oh, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, just the triaxial halo
themselves.
Yeah. I would have to go back and look at it. Right. Yeah.
So yeah, really, really cool idea, Monica. It's really interesting. There's one inertial force term that you didn't discuss, which involves the time derivative of the orbital frequencies of the rotation. Now, normally I would expect that to be completely subdominant.
I'm sure it's, as Ray showed, it's probably flopping around.
Well, that's the thing.
Make things much, much more complicated to model, I think.
Well, that's right. But the thing is, it connects to this issue of the LMC, right? Because the LMC will actually introduce a time dependence into omega. And then that can actually be put into the inertial frame. So I guess it might be interesting to look at whether that term actually becomes large in the presence of the LMC, and if that's one way to put the LMC into your analysis explicitly.
Okay, yeah, that's a good idea to look at that.
Okay, do we have any more questions? We can have another one. Oh, James?
Well, I think what I was going to say is potentially being covered, but obviously the Magellanic clouds by the polarizability of the dark halo will produce a time-dependent quadrupole. And so you would expect, I would have thought, and you mentioned this really also in terms of tidal generation and stuff, you'd expect anyway there was a correlation between the quadrupole and the location the LMC. Yeah, but I mean, yeah, that's...
Oh, so you're saying that you wouldn't expect the LMC to have effects on things which didn't come close by?
No, I think the LMC is obviously...
Okay.
It would have an effect on things that didn't come close by because
okay.
it polarizes the whole halo. This
that's
is
right.
the point
okay.
that Martin Weinberg made a very
right.
long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very powerful and important point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But everything's horribly time dependent. I mean,
it is, right.
Yeah, everything is
it
horribly
is.
Time dependent. I guess having seen Ray's movie,
we have cherry picked.
How can we ever think about this
differently
again?
So, yeah.
Okay, so I think let's thank Monica for the great talk. And before we go through the coffee break,